cellist, vocalist, and educator. Dawn's most recent projects are her album Beloved, about the Sufi theme of spiritual love, and the soundtrack for Heather Henson's A G-Jock on Turtle Island. Production assistance came from Paul Elsnaw of Merging Arts Productions in Pawtucket, Rhode Island. Sprouts is a weekly program produced in collaboration with community radio stations and independent producers across the country, bringing you local radio productions of national interest. The program is coordinated and distributed by Pacifica Radio, thanks to Michael Yoshida at Satellite Operations. If you or someone at your station has a radio production that you wish to rebroadcast on Sprouts to showcase it nationally, contact our air traffic controller, Ursula Rudenberg, at ursula@pacifica.org. That's ursula@pacifica.org. This week's producer was Merging Arts Productions in Pawtucket, Rhode Island. I'm Tony Pinocchi of Merging Arts. Thank you for listening, and see you next week on Sprouts.
KBOO is looking for a grant writer to join our team. We are seeking someone with a proven track record in writing successful, complex proposals for diverse sources of grant funding. Previous experience working in the philanthropic landscape of the Portland metro area is preferred, and previous experiences working with community media organizations and with communities of color are A+. This is a 1-year contract position for a total of 200 hours at $25 an hour, and the grant writer will work closely with the KBOO development director. For more information, go to our website at kboo.fm and click on the KBOO is hiring link on the right side of the home page.
Last night, I dreamt I went to Mandalay again.
Coming to the Monday Sampler,
I stood by the Iron Gate,
an all-star presentation of the classic gothic mystery Rebecca.
Yes. Oh, yes, she was the beautiful Rebecca Hildreth, you know, the most glamorous creature in all England.
Adapted from the best-selling novel by Daphne du Maurier.
Featuring Ida Lupino.
Nothing was covered up.
Oh, Judith Anderson.
The most beautiful room you've ever seen.
And Ronald Coleman.
Please, don't call me Mr. De Winter. I have a very impressive array of first names. George, Fortescue, Maximilian.
Tune in Monday, March 25th at 2 p.m. as the Monday Sampler presents.
Do you believe the dead come back and watch the living?
No. No. I don't believe it.
Rebecca.
This is KBOO Portland. It's just after 11 a.m. And we'll be hearing Pacific Underground, bringing us an encore presentation of Jake Vermaas' conversation with Lillian Ongelungel. They'll be talking about many topics, and we'll also touch on a time-sensitive matter that is no longer relevant, but the rest of the program is indeed timely. Well, not timely, but evergreen, shall we say. That's coming up in just a minute, after I remind you that KBOO programming is made possible by KBOO listener members and support from Portland Underground Graduate School, a local independent learning community offering courses and workshops for continuing lifelong learning. Scholarships and other tuition opportunities available. Course options and more information online at pugspdx.com. And as promised, here is, again, Jake Vermaas speaking with Lillian Ongelungel.
Good morning. You're listening to Pacific Underground on KBOO Portland 90.7 FM. And this week we have a special episode for you coming from the vault. Exactly 1 year ago, dearly departed producer Kat Betwigas and I had special guest Lillian Ongelungel, a super talented writer, poet, storyteller, tattoo artist, any other kind of artist. So enjoy this trip down memory lane.
Da-da, da-da.
Hi, listeners. You're listening to Pacific Underground, and today we've got me, Kat, one of the hosts slash producers, and in the studio with me is Jake as well.
Hi.
And special guest Lillian Ongelung.
So Lillian kind of just introduced herself, but we have Lillian today on the show, and we're going to get into some really cool stuff, talk about a whole bunch of things that we've been here at Pacific Underground been hoping to kind of be able to cover for a while now, just, you know, Pacific representation among the API community. So we're going to go deep into that stuff.
Finally, we're reflecting.
Right. Let's get real, people. Let's get real.
I was trying to relay to Kat where we first met. I think it was either a pano or karaoke or some food-related event.
You know what? It was a food-related event, and it's a really perfectly appropriate one. I believe we met at Tender Table when Alina Lim was giving her talk about, I think, some kind of food that is prepared in Singapore every time for New Year's or something along those lines. I think that's the first time I saw you. I was like, that's Jake. Oh. I recognize him from the internet.
Yeah, yeah. And then we started, from there, we started seeing each other at everything. It was like, oh
actual
my gosh,
everything.
Hey.
Yeah. No, but I think that's a really appropriate starting point because it kind of shows how we're connected to stories. You know, it shows mm-hmm. that we find community in being able to share our narratives with each other. So that's really great. I'm glad that we can kind of come back to that and say, here's our starting point.
Yeah.
Yay, friends.
Yeah. I'm glad we have that connection.
Yeah. So let me pose a question, and we can do this super quick. My question for you guys, when you think Pacific Islanders, when you think tattoos, who comes to mind? And go.
Mm.
So for me, no one specifically, which is, I feel like I have vague sort of ideas about the place and the people, but it doesn't go deeper or beyond that.
Okay, and we're talking just in terms of images you see, like who comes to mind. They don't have to be real.
My associations of that are of that sort of like stereotypical sailor with the anchor and, you know, kind of the westernized appropriation of Islander tattoo art. Mm-hmm. And thinking back to Moana, which we can touch on later, is that like that outfit that had the sort of authentic art from the characters in there that was like a costume.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and we
can
talk
about
that.
Super problematic.
Yeah. Well, I'm glad you mentioned Moana because that's when I usually ask people this question, they say one of two things. They say, oh, The Rock and his tattoos, or NFL players and their tattoos, or Moana just came out. And
right.
So, you know, those things are all really interconnected. And the reason why I ask that is because, you know, I want to ask people, what is the narrative that they see? What's that dominant narrative that they see about Pacific Islanders? And especially when it comes to tattooing, because, you know, some people might know I do tattoo artwork, and I'm really, really interested in, you know, exploring it as a form of identity and also reclaiming the practice for our Indigenous Pacific people. And so, you know, on the subject of stories and artwork and tattoos and building community and identity and all these things, you know, it's really important that we kind of think about, where do these stories come from? Why are they the ones that are the most prominent in our minds and
right,
in our spaces?
Right, because it's kind of an erasure, right?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, Moana has its pros and cons. I think as a movie, it's really incredible that these narratives are out there and that they're visible. And now we have a whole generation of younger people growing up and seeing somebody that really reflects their identity and mirrors their experience and looks like them and talks like them. You know, that's really, really critical and important. At the same time, it's like, but are these forms of storytelling, are they genuine and true to the experience that we have? Who's the person in control of these stories? And to be honest, there was so much erasure of Melanesian and Micronesian people in the story of Moana, or in Disney's interpretation of Moana, you know. So there's scenes where, you know, you have these, I don't even know how to, when I saw the image, it's like you have literal fighting coconuts, evil fighting coconuts.
Oh, gosh.
And the story that that comes from is actually based in Melanesian tradition.
Oh, I
know.
You know,
the Kakamora. And so it's like, are you really, and are you really like doing the community a service by having that story portrayed in a very like Western lens as like these are the bad people, and then on top of that they're coconuts. Like, there's not a lot of racial slurs for Pacific Island people, but coconut is one that's very heavy for some people, you know, to be labeled as white on the inside and brown on the outside, as if you're not valid in your own identity and experience. Like, that can be really triggering and rough for people.
And I've heard, that's one that I've heard too, yeah, for like Filipinos.
Oh, exactly, for sure. And so there's, you know, there's that. And there's also the element of, you know, Micronesian experiences in Moana, like being completely erased, you know. A lot of people don't realize that without Micronesian people teaching Polynesians the ancient art of navigating by sea and star, they wouldn't have that tradition revived the way that
really?
It has been. So a lot of those scenes that you see in Moana where they're doing all of this navigation, those are rooted in Micronesian traditions. But then in the mass marketing of Moana, you have this whole, everything here is Polynesian, this is the Polynesian princess. And it's like, ooh, but actually you're just flattening a ton of really richly diverse and incredible experiences from all over the place. So
And to clarify, we had our mutual friend Malo in here a couple months ago to talk and sort of introduce us a little bit about the distinction between Polynesians and Melanesians and Micronesian communities.
Yeah, which is excellent work, because as much as we are all united by the Pacific Ocean, we are definitely unique in our experiences and how we see and view the world and live through the world. So I'm glad that they were able to come through and give a little 101.
And to sort of like refresh our memory, the typically Melanesians are the darker skinned, and Micronesians are smaller islands.
Yeah, so all of those terms,
Polynesian.
Yeah, you've got Melanesia, Micronesia, and Polynesia comprising the Pacific region. And those are all imperfect colonizer terms. It's not like my ancestors came through and were like, oh, hi, we are Micronesians. We do Micronesian things. You know, that's that's just not how it was.
Right.
And so, you know, in trying to learn about our histories, learn about our narratives, you know, we have to reclaim that. Let's use words that make sense to us, not just because somebody got lost and said, these islands are small, you are now Micronesia, you know.
Right, which is, like Mala was saying, that's a Greek root of a word.
Yeah. Oh,
and
totally.
That's not something that the indigenous folks would have used to sort of, like, relay their experience at all.
Exactly.
Or and identify themselves.
Totally.
And also, like, since we haven't touched on it yet, but your identity is Palawan, is that right?
Yeah, so I definitely identify as Palawan. I'm, you know, definitely raised in Portland, so I identify as a Portland girl too. But there's something about just the way I was raised, the way I grew up. My first language is Palawan, and you know, I'm really grateful for my parents for having me rooted in that, because I see a lot of American-born people, not just in my culture, but there's this kind of common universal diaspora kid experience where your family, your parents, your aunties, your uncles, they all speak and have these traditions and cultural views rooted in some other place. And you grow up as an American, but you also grow up as, you know, whatever heritage you come from. And you have to be, to quote the great Edward James Olmos in the movie Selena, you have to be more Mexican than the Mexicans and more American than the Americans. And it's exhausting. You know, that's a very true experience for a lot of people. And I think when it comes to identity, like, you can't let anybody police your identity. Nobody knows how you live better than you do. So, I've actually been rooting in a lot of cultural work myself, and using tattoo as a form to really reconnect to that. You know, tattooing was a really incredible practice in Palau that was held by women. Women held the knowledge to tattoo, to learn about the clans, to learn about the designs, and to really place those marks on people's skin. And so I'd like to see that come back, and I'm trying to do whatever I can, whatever in my power I can possibly do to keep that tradition strong, and even use it as a form of expression that also ties in our new ways of evolving language and of developing ourselves. So it's cool stuff.
That's interesting. Yeah. Could you talk a little bit about how you came to practice that art?
Because kind of on accident. So I have an older sister who is really interested in tattoo, and I guess her tattoos, I'm not going to speak for her, but just to sum it up, her tattoo journey kind of started at 18, where she goes to my dad and says, hey, can you design a tattoo? And he's like, what? No, tattoos are horrible. Don't get tattoos, blah, 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 blah. But then she really just said, but these are part of our, this is part of our culture.
So that's interesting. Do you know why your dad said such things?
Yeah, I mean, to sum it up, colonization, there's just so much Western influence and so much Western culture and Western ideals being thrust upon Black and Brown people all over the world who have been colonized. And so it's that colonial mindset. But it's really cool because as my sister, kind of talked my dad into seeing, like, these are things that we always had in our culture that were always valued and practiced, it's cool to see that my dad has this artistic evolution as well, as all of us are trying to learn and reconnect and grow and develop in these new ways that are also kind of old ways. We're putting our own twists on it, and so I think it's really incredible. My sister got her tattoo. It was very rooted in, like, our cultural identity. It was her first pull-on tattoo, and
where did she?
So she got an
done?
Armband that was designed by my dad, and it's really representative and symbolic of his culture and his side of the family. And so, yeah, after that, my sister just kind of explored tattoo as a craft and got herself licensed and had an apprenticeship going on, and that was what, about over 10 years ago. So she's been doing that on and off for a while. For me, I got into tattooing a couple years ago on accident when my sister moved back to the Northwest. She just started connecting with other Pacific artists to just get to know who everybody's is in the field. There's not a ton of Pacific Islander artists out in the mainland, but little by little, they're growing in numbers. And it just so happened there were a few Polynesian artists out here in the area. We stopped over there to check it out, just get to know what their style was, what their tattoo lineage was, figure out who they trained under. And they basically said, okay, that's great. You're going to start tattooing with us. And then I just tagged along because I was in this period of, like, midlife crisis fun employment where that's a story for another time. Maybe I can come back and tell it. But yeah, I was going through a period of fun employment, and I was just like, I don't know what I'm going to do with myself. I'm just going to quit my job and figure stuff out later. And the tattoo shop needed the tattoo shop needed a receptionist. So I was their receptionist for a little bit. And the owner of the shop was like, wait a minute, you draw? You're an artist? Do you want to be my apprentice?
Wow.
And so yeah, I was apprenticing at the shop for a while and picked up the tools, got to tattooing on skin, got to drawing my own designs, helping out at a lot of tattoo conventions around the area. It was pretty cool, but, all good things must come to an end, and I parted ways with that shop and have pretty much been freelancing it since, working mostly out of Washington State, since that's where I'm licensed.
Oh, okay.
And so something that I don't know a whole lot about tattooing in general, but so you can do an apprenticeship or learn from someone, but in terms of the specific, like, traditions, the specific designs and all of that, where do you learn that from? Do you, just find someone in the community, or can you, like, look it up? Is there a ton of information that you can look up yourself or do your own research?
Yeah, that's a really excellent question. I think for me and to some extent my sister as well, for us, it's always been asking your elders, what did this look like? What do you remember? What could you tell us about what this means? You know, so there's, I think that has been the most valuable part of my kind of tattoo journey is just hearing stories, hearing what people remember, hearing what's valuable, hearing about how, you know, just hearing about how people's great grandmothers would have their skin just shining in a certain light when the coconut oil was rubbed upon that piece of their body. Just like, yeah, it's so amazing to hear that story. And so for me, that's been a really invaluable source of knowledge, being able to like pass it down through oral tradition, what everything means, and hearing it in that voice has been really incredible. But you know, I do get asked that question a lot for people who are trying to reconnect with their Pacific heritage. So, you know, where do I start? Where do I go if I'm disconnected from my Pacific community in some way, shape, or form? Whether it's physically they're not in the islands, or you know, emotionally they were adopted and maybe they don't have that direct connection to biological family or just to the community. There's a lot of research that goes into it, and some of the best things that have unfolded in terms of, you know, discovering a new thing or learning about a story or learning about a design, ask the elders. There's so much knowledge around us, and I think it's incredibly valuable to be able to start there and figure out where to go next. Because I mean, you can learn heaps of stuff out of books. You know, you can go to the library, hit the books, and find some, I don't know, maybe like a Hawaiian quilt book type of thing. And that's great. You'll get visually a lot of influence in that way. But I think experience holds so much more value in some ways. There's some things you have to experience and not just kind of soak up in a book.
And it's tough when you get the images disconnected from the narrative and the oral tradition. So when it's a book, especially when it's a book written with through a Western lens, you lose a little bit that way.
Exactly. And I'm glad you mentioned that, because there is one example that I can think of where that's exactly the case, where if you look up on Google image search, you search Fijian woman tattoo, and there's two particular images that pop up in the results where historians have always misidentified these two images as being the same person.
Oh, wow.
But it's actually two separate women with two separate tribes, two very separate sets of tattoos. And because people were talking to the elders, they were able to read the tattoos and read the story. So it's like, wow.
Differentiate between the two women?
That's incredible.
Oh, that's beautiful.
And it was all missed because somebody somewhere put it in a book that it was the same person or whatever it is. Like, we didn't have the knowledge to, like, read it correctly. And so when that gets established as the truth and it's not, it's like, oh, somebody's going to find out. So, yeah, just a really cool thing to consider.
Yeah. So if you're just tuning in to us, you're listening to Pacific Underground here with Jake and Kat, and we're talking to our lovely guests, Lillian Ogolong. And did I get that right?
Not really, but no, you know, we'll work on it offline.
So Lillian, something that you mentioned a little earlier was how tattooing as an art was always owned by women, or is that?
I mean, I wouldn't say it was always owned by women. It was practiced by lots of different people, and it varies too across the different islands, but yeah, it was definitely a predominantly women's practice in Palau and in some other islands. So
yeah, because that actually reminds me, and we could probably potentially go into, you know, commercialization or like appropriation. But so in the Philippines, what has lately become kind of a trend, and I don't know if it's if it started from social media or whatever, but this woman who lives in the mountain province of the Philippines, her name is Wang Od. She is about 100 years old, and she is the last, or I think she might be trying to pass the tradition down, but she's one of the last sort of tattoo artists, and her style is a specific style, and it's in the language it's Mamba Batok, and Batok is literally tapping or hitting. Mm-hmm. So I think, not that I've actually really seen it myself, my sister actually got a tattoo from her, went all the way to that part of the Philippines just to do that. But we can come back to that. It's, I believe you use like a carved, like wooden kind of... like
needle pick kind
of
thing.
Something like that. And you kind of like... tap the design into the skin.
I think that's incredible. I think she's a phenomenal woman, and all the more like respect for her to be able to pass down that craft to so many other people willing to learn. I think that's incredibly awesome. But yeah, in the Pacific Islands and even in indigenous areas of the Philippines and indigenous parts of Indonesia, there are so many different ways to tattoo. And there's a lot of different practices. Some of them are more dominant in some areas, where some are, you know, more specific to other regions. So for Palawan tattoo, traditionally, I believe it was a poke method. So more similar to what you'd see people doing, the poke, stick and poke kind of method. That's, I don't know how this became popular, but apparently it is, and I just missed it somehow. Yeah, there's other tattoo practices that are rooted in tradition and have the tap method. So that's when you have like teeth on a tool or an implement that's then tapped into the skin with another stick. And so that's a method that's really common in Polynesia, in Samoa, in Hawaii, as even in the Philippines. And so I think it's really incredible that this huge and vast ocean still has a lot of those things that are commonalities among our different our different people.
But something that I don't know, I don't think I've quite articulated how I feel about it is, so somehow she's become really popular, and so people flock to her village just to get a tattoo from her. I think there might be like a, you know, like you have to wait or something, including, you know, Westerners, foreigners, and... I think there was this one incident as well not too long ago where they actually brought Wang Od down to Manila. So it's like hours away, Manila to like such a huge
metropolitan,
crowded,
city,
messy urban area. And she was brought to a, or she was invited to a, like an expo of some sort. And so, you know, the whole thing, I feel like it's gotten twisted in a way into a more sort of, you know, commercial kind of thing. And I don't quite know what her thoughts are about it. I don't really know if we've done a, or we, the collective, we have done a really good job of like actually asking her how she feels about partaking in this entire thing. But yeah, it's she's become so popular, and everyone everywhere is like, oh, I gotta go get something done before she goes forever and this
symbol.
Thing disappears. And so I don't know if you are potentially seeing like a similar kind of trend, or just you know, this kind of commercialized facet to the art, and especially coming from, you know, like where this is like a deep sort of tradition. Do you have any sort of experiences or thoughts about that?
Yeah, I mean, I'll just kind of premise it first by saying I'm kind of a bad capitalist, like, and as such, as a tattoo artist who happens to be a bad capitalist, like, I am very particular about my clients. There are certain clients that if they don't have a meaning, or if they don't have a meaningful thought process behind their tattoo that I feel comfortable applying onto their skin forever, I can't take them on as a client. And so I'm very intentional about the people that I work with. But that said, that's just me, one tattoo artist. I can totally see how there's this really capitalist consumptive mentality to tattoos, especially as, and I've seen this before, where people kind of have destination tattoos and they collect where they go based off of the tattoos that they have or the names of tattoo artists that they'll kind of collect, which, you know, to each their own, it doesn't hurt me. But where it does become very, you know, kind of an interesting question to consider is just, how is this going to help or harm the community that sees a very sacred meaning behind these practices, where for years and years and years, for example, Maori people in Aotearoa in New Zealand, people were collecting their tattooed heads as trophies across the world in places in Europe and overseas and such. And so it's like, that's part of why I was really, really against the Moana costume as a tattoo, or as the tattoo costume for kids, because really to wear somebody else's skin, even if they were appropriated designs and really commercially done, but here is Disney making money off of all of these fake tattoo costumes where people literally died because of what was on their skin. And to this day, a lot of those ancestors have not been repatriated back to where they belong with their families, with their clans. And so for people to say like, oh, you're overreacting, it's just a costume for kids. Well, no, there's still people who are absolutely mourning the loss of their ancestors, waiting for them to come home. So there's still very much a modern day relevance to the type of appropriation that harms our communities as Pacific people that we do have to, take into consideration with these things. So, for me, like my big action was, you know what, let's start this decolonize Moana hashtag and let's take it off the market. I'm glad that it was successful. So, if that one thing that I did helped to get people some sense of, a little bit of a sense of comfort by making sure that there's ownership of their identities and of their works as a community, then cool. I did a good thing.
Yeah, that's great. I didn't know you were involved with that campaign, but I remember following it on social media and stuff, and I don't have Twitter, but I'm glad they shut it down.
Right.
And so to go back to a little bit on what you were talking about as the connection between the art and the oral history, so how you see those kind of working together, I was wondering if you could talk a little bit about some of the Islander storytelling traditions that you're working on sort of preserving or kind of trying to.
That's great. I mean, as a Pacific person, you know, I come from a storytelling people. We are, we're people who have rich histories of oral tradition. You know, we didn't have like a telegram machine, but we still got the message across, you know, back in the day. And so I really think there's an incredible value to that I think mainstream society is just now kind of waking up to, where, you know, for example, oral tradition was a form of sharing knowledge and even forms of really, really complex science in the Pacific Islands. And so an example of that is in Palau, one of our elders or one of our fishermen could name more lunar spawning cycle types of fish than had ever been recorded in modern scientific studies. And he wasn't our best fisherman. So just imagine if they had asked the best fisherman, you know, just, you know, the kind of knowledge that people retain from storytelling is really incredible. And people for so long in the Western world have always dismissed forms of knowledge that weren't written down, that were not captured in a text. You know, when you think about your college courses, how important was it that you had textual evidence to back up any claim in an essay, right? Mm-hmm. But, you know, it's interesting how studies now show, I believe it was a Stanford study that shows you retain more information through storytelling, because as you're hearing a story, the neurons in your head kind of connect that it's an experience, and you're taking in all this information in really multifaceted ways. So it's not just I hear it. You're also, you're kind of reliving it as an experience.
Like contextualizing it too.
Yeah, but also like
constructing things in your head too. Yeah. So it's not just purely like, you know, something that you hear, like audio, mm-hmm. it's actually also pretty visual, I would imagine, yeah. and very like just tactile yeah. in a way.
And if you think about it, if you hear a story, you're engaging your brain in so many ways that you don't realize. Yeah, you're hearing it, you're seeing a storyteller if you're seeing them live, but you're also creating that vision in your own headspace. You know, you're using your imagination in ways that maybe if you were reading it, you would just see the words, interpret the words, and understand and see only those words in your head. Mm-hmm. But it's really cool because I think it's important that we tell our stories. And as such, I started a storytelling series, and it was largely influenced by my experience in Tender Table, Stacey Chan's mm-hmm. Curated series on women of color and gender non-conforming folks of color who share stories about race and food and culture and the food itself. They bring it and eat it. It's wonderful.
Yeah, it's great.
And even hearing stories from White Noise, you know, hearing a lot of people's works and a lot of people's experiences in that form has been really, really, you know, validating for me to say, hey, yeah, we can do this. I'm just going to go out there and do it. And so back in January, we had our first Pacific Perspectives storytelling kickoff event. And there was a theme to it. So the theme to it was what's in a name? And just people from Pacific Islands being able to share stories about names, whether it's their own name, whether it's the name of a place that they grew up in, whether it's the name of an ancestor they had. So there was a lot of that. And I think it was really cool to just see who showed up. We have another one coming up soon this month. So March 24th at High and Low Gallery in Southeast Portland, we're having another Pacific Perspective storytelling event. So it will be actually co-hosted or co-sponsored in partnership with Utopia Portland. That's United Territories of Pacific Islanders Alliance.
Oh.
And it's going to be their meet and eat event where they also tell stories about what it's like to be the only Pacific Islander in the room. And so,
that's an interesting one.
I think it's going to be a wonderful night.
Yeah, that's great that you sort of decided to take up space like that and, you know, work against that sort of erasure.
For sure. And you know what? Really, when it comes down to it, the only thing that's big about me is my hair. So I will take up as much space as I see fit to be able to offer it up to other folks from islands to be able to have their say.
I see you there, lying in the dark, hiding your face, hiding in the park. I hardly sent you out an invitation for a fight, but now you're haunting me, whispering attacks in the night.
You're listening to an episode of Pacific Underground from the Vault. Last March 23rd with producer Kat and myself, Jake, talking with Lillian Ongolongo.
Running around like you're still 16. No respect is earned, but it ain't for free. Excuse me, what does it really mean? You shoot me down
like a dead Indian.
You hang me dry
like a dead laundry.
You tell me tales
of who you think you are.
You shoot me down
like a dead Indian.
You hang
like
me
a dead
dry
laundry.
You tell me tales
of who you think you are.
Yeah.
If you're gonna pick a fight, why don't you?
Why don't you? Why don't you?
If you wanna pick a fight, why don't ya? If you wanna pick a fight, why don't ya?
Why don't you? Why don't ya?
Said if you wanna pick a fight, why don't ya? Why don't ya? Why don't ya? Why don't you? 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 Why don't you?
So if you're, just tuning in, you're listening to Pacific Underground. My name's Jake Vermoss. I'm here with Kat and Lillian.
Hi, all. I'm Lillian, a Pacific Islander, and I'm very much above the ground
and
right now. Oh, my God. Did I just tell a dad pun? That was horrible. Actually, it may be horrible, but I'm a little proud of myself.
Yeah, no, that was impressive.
Had to, guys.
I'm all about the bad dad jokes.
I suppose we could, Lillian, we could talk to you a little bit more about organizing. I mean, obviously the storytelling is one part of it, and I don't really, I feel like we could go into like specific things, but we could probably just start off with, are there any other sort of things that you're involved in right now?
Oh, wow. What kinds of...
Apano.
What do you do, Lillian? I've been pretty involved on and off over the last probably, I don't know, almost 10 years with Apano. So that's kind of wild to think that I've been a flaky Apano member for that long. I feel like every time Apano has like a new membership coordinator, I'm like, hey, I'm Lillian. I already subscribed to your thing, but you don't know that because you weren't here when I signed up and it, whatever. Yeah, but... Yeah, it was pretty cool. I was one of the original folks with Apano's art and media project, which at that time I was really set on joining an art collective. So I was like, yeah, let's come together and form the arts and media collective. Let's be part of this art collective. And then it turned into a project. And so I was like, okay, peace. But then I came back. So, I'm just trying to come back.
Oh, it was originally called the Arts and Media Collective.
Yes.
Not the project.
Yes. Little history there.
That's interesting. That was a later arrival. Yeah. A little bit less than 2 years ago.
Yeah. You came through and then you were like, who's this girl? And I'm like, I was here first.
So I've really only been to one or two, maybe just the one Apano event.
The Eval.
Right. But...
Which Lillian and I helped
we
organize.
Created. Yay. Go
high
us.
Five.
So in terms of being represented in that organization, or just, sort of any kind of general API sort of community, could you talk about some specific challenges that you've seen? I mean, obviously, kind of... not sort of bringing in more Pacific voices. I feel like that's, I mean, I know it's happening, but could you talk a little bit more about just the ways in which you've experienced that?
Yeah. Oh, for sure. And I think the thing that I notice the most is when people use the umbrella term API and feel as if they're obligated to use it because it's the most politically correct term. But I think it really does do everybody a disservice when you claim API but only specifically serve a population that actually does not include Pacific Islanders. I have no problem with an organization saying, hey, we serve the Asian population right now, and we would like to engage more with Pacific Islander communities to be that full API, very strong coalition of folks. But, it's difficult when the A is uppercase and the PI is lowercase all the time. And so I've experienced that in a couple of organizations, not just, you know, locally, but even on a national level where, you know, sometimes an executive director might get carried away with a huge, you know, national crowd of folks and be like, hey, shout out to all the awesome Asian folks in the room, and then forget to acknowledge that actually you have a whole section of folks from Pacific Islanders that are here and that are present. Or even just the inclusion and recognition of South Asian folks, Southeast Asian folks. And these are all people that kind of get dropped off that uppercase A and API. And, you know, that's why I think it's so important and so vital that we disaggregate our data so that we don't leave people falling through those cracks the ways that they already have been. And so that's a challenge that it's real. It still exists. You know, it's 2018 and we're still struggling to honor and respect different identities to this day. But, you know, I have hope that it'll change. I have hope that we're moving in better directions. And, you know, if our current political climate is unfortunately the thing that wakes people up to that, it is what it is. Let's just take the time to sit with it, acknowledge it, name it, and then do better.
Yeah, it's important.
I mean, yeah, we can definitely all do better. And I'm, you know, just kind of, I looked up your bio really quick.
Oh God, I have a bio? Is this on the internet?
If it's
and
on the
so,
internet, it must be true.
Yeah, in terms of, you know, like cultural work and workshops, community sort of like workshops and things that you've done. I'm just looking at the list of past topics. And I know we've touched on a couple of these, tattoo traditions, decolonizing Moana. But there's like also a couple of interesting looking things here. Critical conversations on dating, sexuality, and Pacific Islander culture. And QTPI, so queer and trans Pacific
cutie
Islander.
Pies.
Oh, cutie pie!
Isn't that great? Isn't that the greatest thing ever?
I didn't even get it.
Cutie pies.
Oh.
It's kind of my favorite acronym.
It's kind of when a pun and an acronym works out.
Oh my gosh,
that's
great.
So brilliant. Cutie pie. Identity. It's not the same thing. I thought these two lines were like the same sentence, but storytelling via zines. So we could chat a little bit about those. Are you still doing these sorts of events and workshops?
Yeah. So I'm pretty flexible when it comes to workshops and teaching them and sharing just knowledge, because I don't think knowledge should be limited to any like one source. Like, I mean, I've taught these workshops everywhere from Salem up to Seattle over the span of the last 10 years. And so really I do it because those are the things and resources that I wish I had a long time ago. And when that wasn't available to me, I think I struggled through a lot of stuff that maybe I didn't need to go through, or maybe could have been facilitated, maybe could have been a little bit more bearable with the help of mentors or with the help of somebody to give a little bit more guidance. And so that's really important to me. I want to make sure that whatever I do in any realm of work that I do, that I leave a place in better condition than I found it. And so that's something that really drives my, you know, my cultural work, is just making sure that I leave everything in better condition than I found it.
Yeah.
Go ahead. Oh, I was just wondering if you, you know, have like the few sort of like topics or areas that you generally like, I want to speak about or like lead a thing about these things, or is it typically kind of depending on who invited you and what they if they have any requests?
Yeah, I think that's an interesting question, because for me, like, I've never gone out there and claimed that I was an expert on any of these things. These are all just things that people request of me for XYZ reason, and I'm more than happy to share it with people, you know. Really, people just approach me and ask, like, what have you done? what can you offer? What kind of input can you give? And I'm just like, hey, let's talk about it. What do you need? And what matches with my, you know, what I'm available to offer you? So in terms of workshops that I lead and offer, I'm very, very collaborative. And I think that's important because you don't want to, at least for me, like I want to be really, really intentional. And I don't want to just invite somebody because they're there and they're supposed to be a speaker and they're supposed to be this and this and this. Like, I do want to be intentional. I do want to make sure that I'm addressing the right audience. I do want to make sure that when I talk about decolonizing Moana, am I going to be speaking to a group of, you know, Pacific Islander college students who have a pretty solid understanding mm-hmm. of systemic oppression and the ways that our narratives have been erased? Or am I going to be talking to a bunch of middle school students at a privileged, predominantly white institution that they just like the movie and the music? You know, I have to know my audience. Mm-hmm. And so I really do like to work with people to figure out what are their needs? Where does my knowledge meet with your needs?
Cool. And so I guess, because we've talked quite a bit about your work and what you do, could we talk a little bit about self-care?
Oh, man. Self-care. That's a theme that's been coming up in my life so much recently. And I think it's a sign that, hey, maybe you should take some time and really take care of yourself. Because for a while, I was doing these self-care sister Sundays with my sisters, and it was usually just an excuse for us to like get together and indulge in something, whether it was like really excellent food or going out and getting massages or going out and getting our nails done or going, you know, it was always something that it's like, for us, it was like something that we would like kind of feel bad and guilty for indulging instead of putting other priorities first. And it just got to this point where I was like, sometimes self-care just means remembering to eat food for that day. Sometimes self-care is remembering that you have to drink water during the day. Sometimes self-care is, hey, actually, you might hate running, but you know you always feel somewhat better physically afterwards.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
You know,
that
like,
is so true.
Because like for me, like learning to love and start new habits is as difficult as quitting bad ones.
Mm.
And that's been very true, because I'm just like, hey, yeah, I should start doing this. And I'm like, but actually, you know, it's difficult sometimes, especially for people who work in the realm of nonprofit industry, you know, the nonprofit fields. Sometimes you feel like you always have to save the day. And sometimes part of saving the day means saving yourself. You know, you can't fill from an empty pitcher. So you got to make sure you're sustained, you're supported, you're full of whatever it is that you need to give to the community. So when people say self-care is community care, that works both ways, you know? If I take care of myself, that means I can then take care of the community. But, you know,
sometimes you gotta be able to say no to individual things.
Yeah. And I actually had a mentor of mine tell me, you know, hey, you know what FOMO is, right? I'm like, yeah, okay, fear of missing out, I get it. Well, do you know what JOMO is? And I'm like, what?
Never heard of it.
Exactly. It's because we don't understand the joy of missing out. Sometimes it's really, really incredible to just be like, ooh, I'm not going to do that today.
Yeah.
And it's true. Sometimes you do have to say no and be okay with it, but then also remember that that can lead to a good thing. Just like how the other day somebody recommended, you know, you have so many to-do lists in your life. Maybe you should have a to-don't list where you remind yourself not to... What's on my to-don't list is currently is don't beat yourself up about stuff that's outside of your control. That's on my to-don't list. So as long as I like am mindful about, oh, yeah, I'm not going to do that, because if I do that, I'm going to just start spiraling down this hole where I'm just, you know, in a puddle of self-misery and pity, you know, and I don't want to be there.
That's no fun.
Yeah, like, nah.
Yeah, a lot of my self-care lately has been just saying no to things. But the to-don't list is intriguing. What is on your to-don't list, Jake? Are you literally writing?
Are you writing down it? A to-do list?
I'm writing down a to-do list. Don't write down a to-do list. That's on my list.
But you know, that brings up a really, really huge question that's been on my mind lately is like, what does culturally competent self-care look like for the API community? What does culturally specific self-care look like to people from our circles, you know? And I don't know that I have an answer for that. Yet. I want to come to an answer to that, but it's just been huge on my mind lately because I haven't seen it yet.
For me lately, my to-do list is that, like, I've recently been getting more opportunities to be invited to read at things lately, which is a good problem to have, but I've also, it's kind of overwhelming sometimes to be able to, like, look at your schedule and be like, no, I really don't have the bandwidth for that one right now. And especially if you feel tokenized a little bit by the opportunity, because most of these are coming from, you know, white organizations or white gatekeepers. And while, you know, there is some value in engaging with that community, and also you don't want to bite the hand that feeds you, right? Because those are the organizations that have the money usually. But I found that being able to say no to some of those is and pick and choose is pretty powerful.
I think on my to-don't list, and I'm definitely still working on it, it's not something that I think I'll be able to, like, cross off and go, like, yep, good with that, would be, not to put myself down so much, because I do a lot of that, and especially lately where, you know, I've been just trying to juggle so many things, and I'm trying to say no, but also I want to be competent and, like, do these things well, and then I feel like I'm flailing because I know I'm doing too much, but then I'm also like, oh, Kat, you know?
It's a difficult feeling to have the sense that you are swimming while you're drowning.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, but I love the idea of a to-don't list. I should think about that more. Yeah.
Can I assign listeners homework? Can I do that? Can I just say, everybody come back with, like, one item on your to-don't list? Or even just think of one thing that you probably do too much that isn't healthy. And just think about how much you do that during the week. You know, it's alarming. Like, this is a bad example, and it's not necessarily on my to-don't list, but a friend of mine was just kind of calling out, you know, when you want to be fiscally healthy, you know, you have to create a budget. You have to figure out where your limits are for what you can spend, what you can't spend. It's kind of the same way, like, if you think about a to-do list versus a to-don't list, it's like, oh, I already did a lot of don't stuff, so maybe I should, like, shift to the do this stuff list, you know, I don't want to end up in, I don't know, self-care debt because I've just been poorly managing myself and not taking care of myself, so.
And exhausted.
Yeah.
Well. So I think we could probably start wrapping up. Lillian, do you have anything that's coming up? I think you might have mentioned.
So Pacific what is on my schedule this year? I don't know. What am I having lunch tomorrow? I don't know. you know, I can tell you a couple things. So I mentioned before, March 24th, there's the Pacific Perspectives event at Southeast Portland's lovely High and Low Gallery. So that'll be with the folks at Utopia PDX. They'll be sharing some stories on what it's like to be the only Islander in the room. And if anybody's in Seattle at the end of the month, I'll be a vendor at the Micronesian Islander Club's annual Micronesian Night. So that'll be cool. Shout out to all the Seattle folks. Go 206. And
shout out to Seattle.
Yeah. We've got Seattle friends, I'm sure.
Definitely.
But I mean, there's always stuff happening. I try to keep my calendar robust and up to date on my website. It's DIRREBES.com. You can find out more about stuff there, what I do. I hate answering that question because it's like, people always ask, like, what don't you do? And I'm always pretty honest. What I don't do is sleep. I need to do more of that just because, like, I've always had really bad sleep hygiene ever since I was a kid, and I struggle with insomnia. But I do want to be more mindful about taking care of myself. So, yeah. Well, I'm working on it.
Lillian, thank you so much. We would love to have you back. Come back every time.
Oh, my gosh, yes. Next time I'm back, I will have, like, a karaoke song prepared or something.
That would be great.
It happened once, but in my head, I was like, this is going to be a new tradition for KBU. I'm just going to sing my way off of the air. So maybe next time it'll be a live show.
I just found out about that, and I have to say my mind is blown. I want to know more. I want to hear more. I want to see it. I want to hear it.
Oh, my gosh, yes. Yes, let's please do this. Let's, like, what are y'all doing tonight? Want to do karaoke? Let's do that.
Right. Yes. But, yeah, thank you so much for chatting with us today, and we'll be back in about 2 weeks, I think, is our next show. So we will catch you all then.
Well, thanks again.
Go team.
Hope everybody has a good day.
I am but a woman, come of age yet so young. Many questions never answered, walk the line, come undone. As I tread the trodden highway, trying to make it my way, I can't help but feel something's wrong. Oh, I will never bow down.
You're listening to KBOO Portland. It's time now for the Noon News.
Thanks, Don. It is time for the KBOO News at Noon for Friday, March 22nd, 2019. Just one day after the U.S. Treasury Department announced new sanctions against North Korea, Donald Trump said today he would lift the sanctions because he, quote, likes the North Korean leader. Trump's rationale for reversing the sanctions appeared to directly contradict his own national security advisor, John Bolton. Bolton argued on Thursday that the sanctions were a significant step toward ensuring North Korea remains isolated over its nuclear ambitions. In other national news, the House Energy and Commerce Committee's Subcommittee on Communications and Technology is expected to hold a markup and vote on the Save the Internet Act, H.R. 1644, as soon as next week. Internet activists are planning an online protest starting Monday with the intention of making the live stream of what would otherwise be a relatively obscure procedural vote go viral to show lawmakers on the committee that, quote, the whole internet is watching. The Save the Internet Act is the only real net neutrality legislation in play this Congress, and that's H.R. 1644. But telecom lobbyists have been pushing hard for